We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Let's move on, shall we?
What are we moving on to?
Well, we're moving on to the Afghanistan papers. Oh, okay. And basically, through Freedom of Information Act's request, rather, some information. And I think what it does, and our guest Chris Fettweiss joins us now, professor of political science at Tulane, specializing in international relations. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning. How are you guys?
I'm all right, sir. What I think, everything I've read so far indicates to me that while the official story from the government was one thing, it kind of puts everything together in one piece that if you've been following this, you could easily infer for yourself. Does that make sense or not?
Yeah, I think that's probably true. I mean, every piece of information that's come out over the last 18 years has been positive from Afghanistan, according to our government. And that just can't be the case. If attacks were going down, it was a sign the Taliban was losing. If attacks were going up, they would say, it's a sign they're getting desperate, we're winning. And unless you had no analytical ability at all, you'd say, well, something's probably not right there. So it wasn't so much that they were lying to us as that they were spinning everything in positive directions, which you know, seemed obvious at the time, I suppose.
And if not, certainly in retrospect, it would. And again, I'm going back to what we all could have inferred. Maybe there wasn't a direct implication. But like you're saying, Professor, if you started to connect the dots here, it's like, well, something's not adding up here. Yeah, and this has always been something that's been near and dear to my heart because I know people that have served in Afghanistan. And to me, you know, the phrase forgotten war was used, and I think it is. I think, Chris, when it comes up, you know, something happens if an American, God forbid, is killed over there, then all of a sudden it comes back into our consciousness, right?
But yeah, that's right.
Between that and the next one, and I don't mean that disrespectfully at all, these people are living that life every day over there, and we don't even think about it. But for them, that is their complete and total reality, if that doesn't seem so esoteric or if it makes sense.
Yeah, that's right. For most people in the United States, they could forget about Afghanistan. Right now, the U.S. casualties are pretty low. They're pretty seemingly manageable. And most of us can forget about the fact that the war is going on at all. But for military families and the people who are going back there six, seven, eight times, depending on your unit, this is a big reality. And it's so depressing to just be reminded that the whole thing, the last 15 or so years, has been essentially pointless. It just, we haven't been able to make any progress, and this report just reminds us that the war is happening, because I think a lot of people, especially with the impeachment stuff, have forgotten about it. And for a lot of us, though, for some of us, you can't forget about it, especially during the holidays.
Since 2001, more than 775,000 troops have been deployed to Afghanistan, many repeatedly, as you just said, Chris. 2,300 have died there. 20,589 were wounded in action. That's according to the Defense Department numbers. And that doesn't even include the people that have PTSD. They don't count that as an injury, do they?
No, they don't. And unless it's severe, they don't count it. And we also have about as many contractors over there, U.S. citizens who have been working for contracting firms, either as security type people or as just people providing services to our troops over there, about as many, about 2,500 or so have been killed. So it's about, you know, somewhere around 5,000 Americans have died over there.
I see a quote here from a retired Navy SEAL who worked as a White House staffer for both President Bush and Obama, saying that after the killing of Osama bin Laden, I said that Osama was probably laughing in his watery grave, considering how much we've spent on Afghanistan. And I guess it's almost $1 trillion. And when you read through this story or stories and read this information, and this in no way, Chris, disrespects the people that are sacrificing, that have paid the ultimate sacrifice, but you have to wonder if they weren't sent on a fool's errand.
No, I think you're right. Tactically, from everybody who has been over there, there's a lot of tactical brilliance at the low unit level. Things have been fought very well. However, the overall mission of trying to shape Afghanistan is essentially impossible. We've had a lot of great powers over the years, including right before us, the Soviets tried to do it. And we've been trying to do it for 18 years. Afghanistan is unshapeable. So all these people saying we didn't have a mission, we didn't have a strategy, in my view, we have an impossible goal here of trying to make Afghanistan look something like Minnesota, of a flourishing democracy where everybody gets along. That's not going to happen. It's never been that way. And to think that we can go in there and just spend a lot of money and put a lot of troops on the line and help them out and make them into our image of what we want them to be was a fool's errand.
There was a, I guess, a lesson learned interview. An organization, SIGAR, or at least SIGAR, did some research into this. In essence, I guess, Chris, what they came up with is that it really is just another Vietnam.
To some degree, I mean, guerrilla wars are always very messy. They're very difficult, and they're very hard to know when you've won because all the guerrillas have to do is keep killing people to keep the war going. So, I mean, and when it comes to how the messaging has been going, a lot of people have been drawing parallels to this week's report to those Pentagon papers that came out in the late 60s, which showed that the government had been lying to a much greater degree about Vietnam people. And this is more so about how the message has been spun and how a positive view has been put onto all information coming out rather than information being made up out of whole cloth. But the fact remains that we're not making progress. And in my view, it's not possible to make progress. And really, it's not much of a point to it at this point. They're not much of a threat to us. They're not coming over here anymore. Hopefully this will get some momentum behind the notion that it's time to get out.
When we pick it up here, the invasion of Afghanistan, the clear stated objective was to retaliate against al-Qaeda and prevent a repeat of the September 2001 attacks. And they're saying they accomplished that part in what, about maybe a year or two? And then for whatever reason, the mission creeped into other areas. We'll pick it up here when we come back. Chris Fettweis is our guest, professor of political science at Tulane, specializing in international relations. If you've not read it, you need to try to get it. I subscribe, so I don't know if you can get it or if it's available from Washington Post. It's called The Afghanistan Papers. And one of the eye-opening parts in this for me, and we'll talk about it when we come back, is that the top military people that were handling this, they didn't want to hear any bad news. So basically, they were killing the messenger. So the messenger then learned, well, I'm just going to tell them what they want to hear. And crap was piled up on top of crap on top of crap, and the truth was not being told. And the people in the field that were getting shot at and giving their lives and sacrificing were trying to explain what was going on, and the people in charge didn't want to hear it. 9:18, back in a flash, WWL. 9:24 now. You know, I think yellow ribbons on your car are nice, and support the troop signs are nice if you want to do that. But I think if you really care about the people fighting in Afghanistan, you need to hold the government responsible for what's going on over there. In terms of achieving a goal, Donald Rumsfeld, who was perhaps one of the most militant defenders of the war, there's a memo quoted from him saying he didn't even know who the enemy was. Disagreements went unresolved. I'm reading from the article. Some U.S. officials wanted to use the war to turn Afghanistan into a democracy. Others wanted to transform Afghan culture and elevate women's rights. Others wanted to reshape the regional balance of power among Pakistan, Indian, Iran, and Russia. And not everybody can get everything they want, and that was part of the failure. They couldn't articulate against whom they were fighting, not to mention why. Was it al-Qaeda, the Taliban, Pakistan, a friend or an enemy, Islamic State, foreign jihadist, warlords on the CIA payroll? And they were talking about Chris Fettweis, our guest, professor of political science at Tulane, specializing in international relations. For those that are listening, and I don't mean this disrespectfully, that think America, yay, and that the government and the military always have the soldier's best interest in mind. That is not what happened here at all. And for example, let me just read what Donald Rumsfeld said, Professor, and I'll get back to you. I have no visibility into who the bad guys are. We are woefully deficient in human intelligence. They want to end corruption in Afghanistan, so they flood the area with money, which in turn does what, Professor?
It makes it more corrupt.
Yep.
Yeah, it's not a bad idea to give money to help the people that we like, in theory, But unfortunately, the people we were giving it to they put it into their bank accounts and didn't go to where it should have gone. And we knew this kind of thing was going to happen, but we thought maybe enough of a percentage of the money we gave would go to the right places that it would do some good. We knew there was going to be a tax, a corruption tax, essentially.
Yeah, and
but it's still bad.
God, I'm sorry. An example of boy, to me, in microcosm, they paid, and there is a hell of a problem with opium growth in Afghanistan as well. So what they did is they paid the Afghan farmers to burn their opium crops. And because these people, you know, you got all this intelligence and money and power behind the United States, and you got this simple guy in Afghanistan thinking, well, you know what? If they paid me X amount to burn 20 acres, I'm going to grow 40 acres next year, and they're going to pay me twice as much. And that's how ridiculously simple it was. Am I right, Matt?
Yeah, you're right. At the time, we were thinking, look, if we don't leave behind some kind of stability, the Al-Qaeda will come back, which seemed to me, even at the time, to be kind of a crazy notion, because if the Taliban doesn't want to see us come back, they're going to see it in their interest to keep those Arabs, who are causing the problems for us on 9/11, the heck out of their country. So the whole thing is tragic just from after about a year and a half or so. We should have been pulling out. And now it's obvious now, but it was obvious to some people then. So it's too bad that it wasn't to our leaders.
They wanted to create, did the government, a democratic government in Kabul modeled after their own in Washington. But it was a completely foreign concept to the people that lived there because they grew up and lived with their way was tribalism, monarchism, communism, and Islamic law.
Yeah, there's really no Afghan national identity. There's really it's been hard for great powers for a long time to convince the Afghan people that they all live in a country together because they more identify with their tribal group or their ethnic group or their religion. And Afghanistan was never really a country in itself. It was a buffer zone. The only reason there is an Afghanistan is because in the 19th century, the Queen had the English had a colony in India, and they didn't want it to touch the Russians. So they made this buffer zone and said, okay, you guys are Afghanistan. And the people there have never really agreed. We've never been able to make them agree that they have a country.
You know, part of the strategy, or whatever strategy existed, was to develop this Afghan military, police force, what have you, that could stand up for themselves. U.S. military officer estimated that one-third of police recruits were drug addicts or Taliban. Yet another one called them stealing fools who looted so much fuel from U.S. bases that they perpetually smelled of gasoline.
Yeah, the people I've known who served in Afghanistan have been told that these people we're going to be working with, you have to be ready and be on guard and be ready to shoot them at any time, because they may not be loyal to us. They may be, we never know who they're working with, or they just may be complete criminals.
And
it's unfortunate.
And those green. And again, Professor, that's something in terms of inferring. When you see these green on blue killings or blue on green killings from the beginning, I don't know if any of us knew who you could. Common sense would tell you, I don't know who to trust or who not to trust, because this one might be purporting to be this when in fact his brother-in-law is that, and everything we try to tell the first one gets told to the enemy, the second one. So it seemed unworkable from the beginning.
Yeah, it's very difficult to understand the tribal connections. And a lot of times the people who would say they would be telling us, oh, you know, those guys over the hill, they're Taliban, they were just in a rival ethnic group or a rival gang or even drug gang. So it's been hard for us from the beginning when Rumsfeld was talking about. He doesn't know who the bad guys are, because we're getting so much misinformation from people. It's a very complicated area.
I'm sorry, narco traffickers, opium. No single agency or country was in charge of the drug strategy. State Department, DEA, U.S. military, NATO allies, and Afghan government all butted heads because nobody really knew what they were going to do. And going back to the poppy farmers from before, where okay, the British said, well, we'll pay you if you burn your crops. They grew twice as much. They got paid twice as much. And then the British caught on to this, and they said, well, you know what? We're not going to pay you anything. So the farmers got PO'd and sided with the Taliban at that point.
Yeah, and the Taliban was then profiting from the heroin trade. So it's super complicated. And the bottom line is that there's really no way to do this. It's not so much that we had a bad strategy. It's just that we've tried everything, and nothing has worked. So at some point we have to realize, and I'm hoping that some good will come out of this, and people will realize after this article that there's really nothing we can do here. We've done all we can do, and maybe start pulling out.
Well, one thing I want to address when we come back, Michael Flynn, who is either in prison or heading to prison, and I know he, not in relation to this, but he was one of the few people, and President Obama told President Trump not to trust him, perhaps for different reasons with the Russians. But he was one of the few guys that had a handle on what was going on in Afghanistan and saying, guys, this ain't working. We don't know who we're fighting. We don't know what we're supposed to do, what the goals or objectives are. So we'll pick it up there when we come back. Chris Fettweiss, our guest producer, professor of political science at Tulane, specializing in informational relations. Somebody texted in talking about Trump supporter, this, that, the other thing. This spans three presidents. This goes from when it initiated with George Bush and then got diverted into Iraq. President Obama continued it. President Trump inherited it. So I would please ask those of you that are looking at this strictly through a political prism to read the article and educate yourselves, because this information is coming from the military people that were involved and the diplomatic people that were involved in it firsthand. And the only reason the Post got this was because they sued through Information Acts to get it. 9:32, more when we come back. Tommy Tucker here, WWL. 9:39, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Please try to find these Afghanistan papers from the Washington Post. I subscribe, and a lot of these things have, you know, you get X amount of free articles a month or whatever. This they should waive the pay window for this, because I think it's that important. So in terms of Michael Flynn, who is facing sentencing for lying to the FBI about meeting with a Russian ambassador, and for people that are thinking he's going to jail for or could go to jail for espionage or something like that, it's nothing like that at all. But he, Chris Fettweiss, professor of political science at Tulane, specializing in international relations, he seemed to be one of the few in command that was saying, guys, this is a mess.
Yeah, he was universally praised when he was essentially the head of U.S. intelligence in Afghanistan. He was working with General not MacArthur. Well, his name will come to me in a second. He wasn't working with MacArthur.
McChrystal?
Yes, yeah. I blanked out for a minute there. But he was absolutely universally praised. But then he ran into some trouble when he got promoted and did other things. But he was one of the folks, apparently, quite skeptical of the mission, not the mission so much as the tactics and the strategy that was being employed. And then he realized that this may be an unwinnable situation, and that, which is something that the upper levels of our military will never admit, that something's unwinnable. They're trained to not.
Never publicly. Admit it, but maybe amongst themselves. And that goes to, Chris, what I spoke about before, about killing the messenger. A lot of times they didn't want to hear anything bad, even if it was true, correct? The uppity-ups?
Yeah, that's true. And what you said before was so right about how this shouldn't be a partisan issue. These were mistakes made under three presidents. And once we start thinking about foreign policy or Afghanistan through domestic political prism, we're not going to be thinking straight about it. I tell my students all the time that politics is the enemy of strategy in foreign policy. That if you're thinking about domestic politics, you're going to screw up foreign policy, and this can't be a partisan issue.
I think that is one of the best lines I've ever heard, being a geek as it relates to this stuff. Say that again, Chris.
That politics is the enemy of strategy in foreign policy. If you're thinking about politics, we're going to screw up foreign policy. The first step for all your listeners to becoming a more, say, sophisticated thinker about foreign policy is try, to the extent you can, to remove politics from it and remove your domestic political opinions from it, because there's no Republican foreign policy and Democratic foreign policy. There's just a U.S. foreign policy.
I am so glad that you said that, because it is absolutely true. Again, this goes to Bush, to Obama, President Trump. I don't know. Maybe we can go into that a little bit. I'm not trying to get political here at all. But we know about Bush's legacy. We know about Obama's legacy. What about the president and current President Trump and his approach to this whole mess over there in Afghanistan?
Well, he certainly wants to get a deal. He wants to get the U.S. out. It's one of his campaign promises to start winding down. But the way that we've been trying to do it over the last year or so is we've been ratcheting up the pressure on the Taliban which has meant just ratcheting up the amount of the number of attacks that have been going on. So the intensity of the war has actually increased, at least from the Afghans' perspective. We haven't lost too many more soldiers, or that pace is not increasing. But there's a lot more civilians dying now, and there's a lot, and we're hoping that will bring the Taliban to the negotiating table. But there was a breakthrough about 6 months ago. It looked like we had a special ambassador, this guy named Zal Khalizad, who was an Afghan American, who was very well respected on all sides of the aisle. He's been trying to broker a behind the scenes deal with the Taliban, but it seems to be foundering. And there's really not any indication you can trust what the Taliban says, but it might give us the kind of cover to get out. So it seems like the president wants to get a deal to get us out, but whether or not we're going to be able to get one that is lasting and we can trust is another kind of story.
And people have to realize, and I'm not taking up for anybody, I'm not injecting politics into this, but President Trump inherited a mess that was, what, 16 years in the making?
Yeah, the biggest mistake President Obama made in foreign policy, in my view, was continuing this war. Listening to his generals who convinced him a few years in, I think it was 2011-ish, to essentially try a surge. There was this notion that the surge had helped us in Iraq, which is a large part mythology, but still they convinced President Obama that maybe an equivalent kind of surge would work in Afghanistan. And he had the opportunity to get us out and didn't do it, and I think he will be regretting that for the rest of his time.
I always wonder about motive, and why would a general or military want to keep conducting a war that they, if you even want to call it a war, a mess that they know they couldn't win? Why would they want to do that? What would the motive be?
They are trained to never think that they can't win. They might be thinking they're not winning now, which means they got to change. But from the beginning, especially our officer corps, and this is how we want them to be trained, by the way, but they're always trained that you can win. They never, ever give up. You know, the Army and Navy football team never give up on the football field until the end. It's the same thing in a war. They'll never give up and never say, this can't be won, especially when we have so much overwhelming advantages in Afghanistan. So it's actually up to the political leaders to say, hey, whoa, whoa, whoa. This is not just a contest out there. This is essentially what is one of the things they say about war: politics by other means. We have political goals here. We have national interests, and it's not just about winning and losing. It's about making a better peace. So it's more of a failure of our political leadership than our military leadership, because it's going to be every single time we get into a war, our military leaders are not going to want to leave until we've won. That's 100% guaranteed. So it's up to the president. It's up to our secretaries of defense to say, hey, look, this is not worth it anymore. We're going to pull out.
One of the quotes that I saw in there from a military source was that the presidents are the commanders in chief, right? So the biggest failings as commanders in chief of both President Bush and President Obama was Afghanistan, the biggest failure, because they didn't have at any point, being the leader of the military, a clear strategy as to what it was they were trying to accomplish.
Yeah, it's certainly the fault. It flies in the fault of the president. In a lot of ways, Iraq was a bigger failure because that was sort of an unforced error,
which
bigger tragedy.
And which hurt the effort in Afghanistan, because it kind of took their eyes off of Afghanistan for a while, and all the while that war kept going on.
That's absolutely true. That's absolutely true. A lot of our assets, our intelligence assets and our attention and our money went to Iraq. Now, in the early decisive years of Afghanistan, now, whether or not it would have made a difference in the long run, whether it would have proved Afghanistan would have proven shapeable if we had not taken our eyes off the ball, I don't know. It could have gone differently, though, if President Bush and President Obama had made different choices. By the time President Obama inherited it, we were set on a path. It wasn't going to get any better. He should have recognized that, especially a few years in. It's hard, though. It's hard for any president to admit failure. Think about all the grief that President Obama got for pulling out of Iraq. It would have been the same in Afghanistan. And it's hard for any president with a little bit more effort, we can win. And my generals are telling me, just change the strategy, we can win. That's the easy choice to make. It's actually more courageous to admit that, hey, this is not working out, fellas. We're going to pull out.
And again, at this time of year, it's nice, and I'm not trying to demean anybody, Chris, to send boxes of socks and cards and mm-hmm. put a yellow ribbon on your car and support the troop sign and so forth. But if you really want to support the troops, you need to hold the government accountable for what's going on in Afghanistan. I'm reading this paragraph. First, we went in to get Al-Qaeda. and to get al-Qaeda out of Afghanistan. And even without killing bin Laden, we did that. The Taliban were shooting back at us, so we started shooting at them, and they became the enemy. And ultimately, we kept expanding the mission. So George Bush, Donald Rumsfeld didn't want to sit down with the Taliban leaders because they thought that, you know what, we can conquer them. But now that is exactly with whom they are negotiating, is it not?
It certainly is. We have to. They're the enemy there. You don't make peace with your friends. You make it with your enemy. And it's important for everyone to realize the Taliban, even though they are extraordinary creeps, they are among history's great jerks. They are locals. They've never killed anybody outside of Afghanistan and Pakistan. They're not going to be taking a jihad over to here. That's not the Taliban. They were supporting people who did that. But all we have to do essentially is get them to say we're not going to support them anymore, which might not be that difficult because they don't want us hanging around there either. And if they start hanging out with al-Qaeda, with these Arabs who they gave some comfort to, then we may come back. So all we have to do is tell them and make it clear, don't make any more deals with al-Qaeda and we'll get out of your country, which is probably an agreement they would live up to.
Couple of fun facts before we run out of time with you, and I say that tongue-in-cheek. Five of the Taliban's negotiators currently are former U.S. prisoners of war who each spent a dozen years in captivity at Guantanamo.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's not a bad thing, though, to let people out who will be able to talk to us.
No, I understand that, but we could have been negotiating with them before they went to Guantanamo, could we not?
That's true.
Or at least while they were there.
Good point,
So another paragraph here, and I want to get to Pakistan before we run out of time. Other officials said the Bush administration compounded its early mistake with the Taliban by making another critical error, treating Pakistan as a friend. We found Osama bin Laden hiding in and probably being protected by Pakistan, did we not?
Yeah, every single high-profile al-Qaeda arrest we've made has been in Pakistan. And that's not a coincidence. And people ask me, is Pakistan a friend or an enemy? I say, yes. They are a complicated country. And to figure that out, some people think we need to reform them. And I think, oh, my goodness, what are you talking about?
Professor, I would believe in his heart of hearts, and I know you can't speak to this other than through history, but I would have to believe George Bush in his heart of hearts knows that Iraq was a big mistake.
I like to think he does, but it's hard for people to admit mistakes, especially when so many people have died because of your choice. He might not admit that.
Do you think Donald Trump, President Trump, the way he's conducted himself so far, has the chutzpah, whatever word you want to use, to say, you know what, that's it. Like me, hate me, I don't care. This is foolish. Enough is enough. We're coming home.
Yeah, if you're an optimist, you may think this president may just forget all advice and say, hey, pull out. Get out, everybody. If any president's going to do it, it might be him.
The results could be the same whenever we leave, is it
That's
not?
That's right. Either they're going to have a civil war now when we leave or in 20 years when we leave.
Thank you, Chris. I appreciate your time. I really
do. Thank you, sir.
We needed somebody to help walk us through it, and you did a great job.
No,
we'll talk to you again soon.
Thank you for your time.
Hi, Chris Fettweiss, professor of political science at Tulane, specializes in international relations. Again, everything we just talked about, I think we all knew was happening, but now it's really been fleshed out and confirmed, I guess. We'll be back. WWL.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.